succession number 28355, reel 1.
Lord Craig, thank you very much indeed for agreeing to contribute to the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. It's very much appreciated. Could we start, please, with your full name and your date of birth and where you were born, please?
My full name is David Brownrigg Craig. Brownrigg is all one word. And I was born on 17th of September 1929 in Dublin, in a nursing home in Baker Street, in City of Dublin. And I lived in Dublin then through most of my childhood, or in fact all my childhood. We lived first of all in Leeson Park. My father was about 20 years older than my mother. He'd been injured in the First World War and lost a leg. And sadly he died when I was 13. I went to prep school, Castle Park in Dublin, and my mother had been very keen that I went to Radley because her brother had been at Radley and he had been killed in the First World War, so I never knew him. And she'd made up her mind that I should go to Radley. And by the time I was 13, it was 1943, and so I was put on the mail boat in Dunleary Harbour, went to Holyhead, where I was to catch a train and meet somebody I didn't know who'd have the proverbial Times or something under his arm at Chester, and he would then take me on to Radley. It didn't quite work out like that. I didn't get on the first train out of Holyhead, so by the time I got to Chester, my escort had moved on to Radley, and I, in the blackout, which of course I wasn't used to, because in Southern Arm we were completely free of all of that, I made my way at the ripe old age of 13 across the rest of England, changing stations in Birmingham in the middle of the night, arriving at Oxford Station at about 6:30 in the morning, where the station master, I think, decided that I needed some help, so he rang the warden, who turned out and picked me up. And I was bedded down in the warden's lodgings, to be woken about 3 or 4 hours later by my housemaster, known as Tutor at Radley, all housemasters and tutors, who said to me, "Get up, boy," and that was my start at Radley. I loved Radley, you know, I was very lucky there. I was just the right side of the age group, which sort of brings you into junior colts and colts and so on, so I was quite successful at Rugger and played in the first 15. I rode and I was in the first 8. I was captain of Rugger. I was head of social and head of the school, senior prefect. So my time at Radley was very enjoyable. I did the usual thing, school certificate. I went into classics to start with, but it wasn't for me, and so I switched to science and mathematics and concentrated on that, got my high school certificates in that. I used to travel backwards and forwards, of course, still during the war, via Holyhead or sometimes even up to Belfast and then down by train.
Was there any danger in the IRC?
The boat used to zigzag frantically. I think there were U-boats around from time to time. Fortunately, never found us or took a shot at us. So time at school, very happy. The one great sadness, of course, was that my father died in my second term, and my mother then could not have afforded to keep me at Radley, but because her brother had been killed in the First World War, there was a war memorial fund which I benefited from, and in fact Radley, or that fund, paid for the rest of my time at Radley, And just as a way to jump forward for a moment, as you know, my full title is Lord Craig of Bradley. And I added the Radley to my name really because of that generosity at that time. Because without that, I wouldn't have stayed at Radley. I wouldn't have gone on to Oxford. I wouldn't have gone into the Air Force. I wouldn't have ended up where I am now. So that's why Radley got added to my name. But anyway, back to school. I left in after a year as senior prefect in 1948. Now, I'm a Southern Irishman born in Dublin, so I'm not liable to national service. So I can go straight to university. I got a place at Oxford. I got a bursary to Lincoln College, which again was essential financially. And I had every intention of becoming a schoolmaster. I'd loved my time at Radley. I was reading pure mathematics at university, and I thought that I should be able to become a maths master. And my mother, who herself had been not only a double first at Trinity College Dublin, but a schoolmistress, was at one stage in her life, was delighted about this. And I had an interview with the headmaster at Eton, and I was offered a job if I passed my finals. But I didn't end up teaching, as you will realize. So why the change? Well, after about a few months at Oxford, I saw a notice about the University Escadron, so I joined the University Escadron. It was free flying. In fact, you were paid to fly, and there was a bounty, which in those days was a very important part of my income, as it were. And I loved the flying, and I had a very fine rector at Lincoln College, a chap called Keith Murray, Lord Murray of Benchley. And he'd been in the Royal Air Force during the war. And he took a kind interest in me. And he arranged for me to go and see Lord Douglas of Curtiside at what was then British European Airways. He arranged for me to go down to Bristol Aircraft Company, possibly using my maths for aircraft design. He arranged the Eton interview, and he arranged one or two other sort of things. So I had a, thanks to his kindness, a lot of guidance on possible employment and opportunities. And I decided to, you know, I would join the Air Force. To which I may say my mother wasn't too chuffed. I was bound to kill myself. Objection two was that Bina Geddes axe, and I was bound to be axed out after a short while. Bear in mind, we are now talking about 48, 49, 50 sort of period, a very short time after the Second World War. And, you know, the future of the Cold War hadn't sort of settled down. The Korean War was around, about to be around. But nevertheless, you know, I was bound to get axed. It wasn't a very sort of secure employment. And if you had to join the services, which you totally didn't really, I think, approve of, you know, why the Air Force? The Army and the Navy had been around for a great deal longer, and the Air Force was about 25 years old at that time. So she wasn't too chuffed, I'm afraid. But, she was living over in Dublin, and I was in this country. And I didn't spend all my holidays even at home. There was a sort of slight separation of the ways. And anyway, so I went up to Oxford, as I say. I was a spare man for the Blue Boat in 1950. In other words, my rowing at Radley had brought me into the big league. I had a trial for rugby as well, but I stuck to the rowing. I read pure maths. There was no maths tutor at Lincoln College, so I kept getting farmed out to various maths tutors in other colleges, Exeter, Merton. I can't remember the names of many much about them. I went to very few lectures. I spent a good deal of time on the river, obviously, and it was only by the final year that I reckoned that I was really going to have to pull my socks up to do some work, which is what I did, and I used to work a great deal in the library. My first year had been in Lincoln College itself, but you were then expected to move out, and I moved out to the digs which a Mrs. Bunce ran. I was the only student there. I was the only guest there. And she would open the bathroom once a week so that I could have a bath. And I got a small jug of hot water, but she gave me a very good breakfast. It was very close to the Oxford University Esquadron headquarters, so on my way to the library to do some study, I would look in, and if there was a free slot, I'd probably go and get airborne rather than go and do my work. But so, you know, time at Oxford was good.
May I just interrupt just for 1 second and ask something about? I had a note and was going to ask about finance going to Radley, which you've answered. Did you have brothers and sisters? And what did your, how did your family survive in the general way after you were 13, after your father died?
Well, yes, I had a sister 2.5 years older than me. Sadly, she died of cancer in her mid-40s. So my mother worked for SAFA, and also did was an examiner for school certificates and so on. So she did quite a lot of correcting, or marking rather, of papers.
Now, she herself must have been a most unusual woman. She would have been, if it would have been 1920 when she got her double first.
Yes, she was born in 1899.
She was born in 1900, so she would have been 1920-ish, 21.
They married in 27. I was born in 29. My father was born in 1880, so as I said, there's a 20-year difference between them. He was an architect in Dublin, worked for the Board of Works in Dublin. I found out some interesting things about him. It's funny how these things happen. Because he died when I was quite young and hadn't been all that well through my sort of 11, 12, 13 period, I didn't, well, I saw him a lot, but I didn't sort of, you know, we didn't do very much together. As an architect, he'd belonged to the Irish Architectural Society, which I hadn't heard anything about till a neighbour in Pimlico here, who was an American but interested in Georgian architecture. I don't know if we're going way off the bill.
No, we're not. Not in the slightest.
Showed me a pamphlet of this Georgian society, which had an advertisement for the Irish Architectural Archive, I think it was. So I wrote off to them and said, you know, my father was an architect, do you have any record on him? And I heard nothing, and then I wrote again, and apparently one letter gone astray. And there's a story within a story here, but she came up with this archivist with a lot of information about my father, which I had no knowledge of whatsoever. They'd been president of this architectural society, and she gave me his president's address for that particular year, and various other bits and pieces about him, which I was totally unfamiliar with. But as it happened, she turned out to be the daughter of a master at Radley, a chap called Charles Rinch, and he's dead now, but he was in his 90s when I was in communication with this daughter. So there was a sort of a loop going around. Anyway, going back to Oxford, I had a very happy time there. A lot of my contemporaries, of course, had done national service, so they tended to be a year or two more, 3 years older than me, quite a lot of them. but I seem to manage to cope with that. I then joined the Air Force, did my training initially at Cottesmore, where I did my wings course.
You joined the Air Force in about
51. Yeah.
And absolutely no difficulty at all in being a citizen of the Republic?
No, in 1948, all of us up to that time had British passports. And in 1948, you had the option of retaining a British passport or having an Irish passport, which my sister did. I retained my British one.
And she stayed in Ireland for her life, did she?
No, no, she eventually married a Swiss.
Oh, right.
So I have four Swiss nephews who are dual national because they can take my sister's Irish nationality as well. Which, from their point of view, being Swiss, means that they are able to work in the European Union. Countries,
of course,
without
any
difficulty,
let or hindrance,
and that who knows, something has come out of that. So, anything else about the early period of life? I mean, you, like all these things, you can go on and on.
Of course,
but I
of
didn't
course.
I wanted to.
No, no. I think
spend too much time.
No,
on
no.
That.
I understand that. No, I think you've given. An excellent resume of your early life. So I'm happy if you finished with that to start in 1951, where you joined the RAF.
Yes, I mean, I joined the Air Force in 1951. I did my wings course at Cottesmore, which is an FTS whose number I've forgotten, 7 FTS, I think. I didn't bring my logbook, which perhaps that would have been a great help, because I would have got some of these dates out of it without trying to drag them out the back of my head, but we can no doubt correct dates later if we've got them wrong. Because I'd done my university air squadron, and I've forgotten how many hours, said a number of hours, I'd flown Tiger Moth, soloed on Tiger Moth, and then flown Chipmunk, which was introduced during my time at the air squadron. And I'd had an opportunity to get airborne in a meteor jet, and
as pilot, but obviously with an instructor behind you.
Yes, in a two-seater meteor 7.
That must have been fun.
Well, yes, it was a great experience for an undergraduate. I went to Biggin Hill. Some of my friends in the university has gotten doing the national service, joined those auxiliary air squadrons, and there was 615, and 6615 was a Biggin Hill, and I went down to see some of my friends there once or twice, and that led to, through my instructor actually, the air squadron, to getting an invitation to go and fly with one of the meteor instructors at the Biggin Hill. So I was got another happy experience being up at 20,000-30,000 feet, looking out over the English Channel across to France, which of course brought back many happy memories of my time at university, because I had a girlfriend then whose parents were very keen yachts people. I'd learnt my sailing in Dublin Bay, crewing on one of the 24-foot class boats there. The dentist as a skipper. He's also my real dentist, a lousy dentist that my teeth will tell you, but he was a brilliant skipper. And I learned a great deal about sailing from him. And then I used to go, thanks to this girlfriend, and sail with her and her parents, or cruising out of Hamble across the channel around the French coast. And spent two very happy summers like that, and I used to go on even, you know, after what you might call the friendship with my daughter had, as it were, passed on, but I still used to sail with the parents. And as a result of that, and so we're going all over the place, but as a result of crewing with them, one Whitson, I was in Yarmouth Isle of Wight, and the next door boat was skippered by a chap called Donald Tree, who had a crew in the shape of one June Derenberg, now June Craddock. And so that's how my wife and I met. But sort of going back, so I mean, that all came in because of the meteor and having a view of this channel. Just a little sort of side swipe at how one met one's wife. The Air Force, because I've been in the Air Squadron, I had a shortened wings course. I think it was 6 months or so. And we were flying Harvards, and I guess I'm a reasonable pilot, a good pilot, so I found that all very straightforward. I got my wings. I then went on to buy Meteor aircraft at RAF Driffield, which with a view to going into the fighter force summer. In fact, because they had a scheme where some students were what's known as creamed off and went straight into instruction, and that's what happened to me.
I went. Did you have any option or say in that?
No, I was just told to get
arbitrarily.
In a way, it meant they thought you were A, capable of flying the aircraft, and B, instructing. I mean, the idea of teaching, going back to my earlier sort of thoughts of career, certainly appealed, so I had no difficulty with that. So as a result of that, I then went to RAF Western Zeeland, where I was instructing on Meteors.
Now, this is Somerset.
That's down in, yes.
Yes.
Somerset.
Yes. So that airfield was still...
That was still active there, yes. The M5, I think, just about cut through it.
Cut it in half. It's right by the battlefield.
Yes, that's right. It always doesn't look very much if you do try and find it, or when you have found it. But the I spent a couple of years there. I think the thing of interest there particularly is that a large number of the students, well, there were two types of students. There were those who had done their initial flying in Canada, where the weather was perfect, and no cloud in the sky. And then when they came back to this country, they were expected to do some flying still under instruction before going on to their squadrons to get used to what you might call English weather. So one was doing a lot of instrument flying tests for them. And the other group within the student body were quite senior Air Force officers who'd been in the war and done nothing but fly piston engine aircraft. And they were coming to get exposure to, or indeed even to go on to be command squadrons or stations with jet fighters on them, or jet aircraft. And so I had a number of students whose logbooks were in the thousands compared, or hundreds anyway, compared with mine, 100 or 200 or 300, whatever it was, and very experienced aviators. And it was quite a challenge, to cope with.
I was going to ask, was it quite a challenge to teach these?
Yeah, I mean, I learned a sad lesson on one of those students, a chap, I don't think I need to mention his name, but he went on to command a javelin squadron, and in fact was stationed, and I was by that time on Hunters, and he killed himself, or got killed in the javelin in bad weather. I think it was almost certain because he had a Sprog navigator with him rather than his regular navigator, who I'm sure kept a good eye on him. But I'd had some difficulty in getting him up to an instrument rating standard. And I think, been a 20-20 hindsight, I certainly shouldn't have awarded him his instrument rating, which I did. Mm. He'd been my student, and I was an instrument rating examiner. And I, you know, instead of getting somebody else to examine him, I examined him, and yes, he got through, but it was, he'd always had to struggle with it. And you know, you come across people like that. It's, in a way, no criticism. There's a criticism more of myself than of him. But, so that was a sadness. Anyway. But apart from that, you know, Western Ireland, I had 2 years there, I think, building up a lot of experience on flying. In those days, we were much more cavalier about flight safety. In fact, going back to Driffield for a moment, I think when I first tried to arrive there, I went into the bar, and by the time I went in, there was an almighty crump outside, and one obviously fairly old, wizened pilot turned to another one and said, "There goes the next one." There was about a fatality per course at Driffield, and I think at other stations in those days, which was in part due to the sort of standards expected. You know, most instructors with wartime life had been, if not cheap, you know, you certainly had to take risks, and you expected that to go on rather than the sort of peacetime environment, which has pertained much more rightly in recent years. But again, at Western Ireland, one thought nothing of flaming out an engine just as soon as you reach safety speed. I was making quite certain the student didn't kick on the wrong rudder. And you certainly did flame out landings, I suppose.
Can you just tell me what a flame out?
A flame out landing, a twin engine aircraft meet you. And you would flame out one of the engines. So you were then flying.
Which means you switch it off?
Yeah. Switch it off, flame it out. Because there's a flame in there, so yeah. Flame out.
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
Switch it off, yeah, yes. Turn the key. You turn the fuel off and then yes. Stop. Flame out. technical thing. And if in a Meteor, if you were making an approach, if you lowered full flat, you couldn't overshoot on one engine. It was too much drag. So, but equally, you wouldn't attempt to lower, shouldn't attempt to land if you've got flap available without putting down full flap. So there was a slight catch-22 situation that you had to get yourself into a position on finals on one engine where you were confident that you would get in, your speed was right and your height was right. And you then put full flap down and you were then committed to land the aircraft. And most of the time that went fine. Occasionally people got it wrong. But I suppose I made, you know, 30 or 40, maybe even 50 flame-out landings in a month. So, you know, nowadays you never ever flame out an engine unless it's, you know, you're in serious trouble with a fire in the engine or something like that.
So would modern pilots practice on the simulator?
Oh, yes, yes.
Rather than in
yes,
the air?
Yes, well, you certainly wouldn't, you know, on tornado aircraft, you wouldn't. You might do a landing with one engine throttle back, but it's always there if you want it.
Yes.
But you wouldn't try and do it just on one engine. So, I mean, I mentioned this really just to give a flavour for the sort of climate of flying in those days.
Yes.
It, I suppose the only sort of real excitement I had there was there was another airfield, Merrifield, about 10, 12 miles south, with parallel runways to Western Ireland. To the uninitiated, not dissimilar, except for the fact that Merrifield was flying Vampires and we were flying Meteors. And every now and then, one of the Merrifield Vampires would decide that Western Ireland was Merrifield and would attempt to land there. And some would realize the mistake and overshoot. But I was doing one of these flame-out landings and found myself committed with a Vampire approaching downwind from the other end. So Fortunately, there was reasonably hard grass on either side, so I went down on the grass, and the vampire went past me on the runway. These were sort of little experiences which you learned from, as I think one always does in all flying. So I then finished at Wilson's Island. I got married just about the same time. I did a short course at, on my gunnery at Stratus Hall before joining 247 Squadron at Odium. 247
in Hampshire.
In Hampshire, yes. Near Farnham. And it, with the 247 Squadron was just converting to the Hunter, Hunter 4s. And so, you know, my first few days there were sorties there were spent where there was no dual Hunter in those days. You were just given the book and shown your way around the cockpit, and off you went. And it worked very well.
Was it an easy aircraft to fly?
Lovely aircraft to fly. It had a slight shortcoming at those days. I mean, this is a frontline fighter squadron. It had four Aden guns, but unfortunately, if you fired the guns, the engine stopped, and so we weren't